the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, this program, I think we should talk about what is the value of what we measure things in. We measure things in dollars. We talk about dollars. We talk about the printing of dollars. We talk about inflation and deflation concerns. But in reality, unless we understand the grassroots of the basic value of the dollar, how in the world can we measure the rest?
Well, and I think this gets to the basic point of what is a currency. It is a unit of measurement, and by it, we value or measure other things. But it still has to have the ability to be that unit of measurement. And there is a degree to which we assume a constancy,
right,
when in fact, starting in 1971 and before that, a slow deterioration in this 100-year period, we've moved away from a constant reference point to begin with, which leads us in a very difficult position, Kevin, because it really is impossible to look at stocks. It's impossible to look at bonds. It's impossible to look at real estate or ranch land with any appreciation for what the real value is.
Right.
And we'll explore that a little bit today.
Well, David, before we go into that, there's another question that's been on everyone's mind. Of course, we all know that QE1, QE2, it does dilute the value of this dollar that we're talking about. And we'll go into more detail, I'm sure, as to just how it's being devalued. But QE3 is on the minds of people. We're hearing some people say, well, gosh, maybe we should just cut QE2 short. Maybe we can go without QE3, when in reality, isn't the economy running completely on stimulus money?
That's right, Kevin. And if you took away the stimulus money, you're talking about an economy that can't survive. We are seeing aggregate demand supported to roughly the tune of 10% of GDP. And so the fact that government is willing to step in spend in the absence of the consumer, it's very significant. Can we get away with QE2 ending? Will we have a QE3, QE4, QE5? I think the case is best made that we'll see an infinite number of QEs. The question is, what do they look like? Are they rebranded? And how strategically are they rolled out?
Well, let me ask you this then, because there's a lot of public criticism right now for the printing of money and the QEs, and the Fed is actually starting to feel a little bit of heat. How in the world are they going to be able to do that without making the public mad and actually causing the inflation fears to increase?
And on top of that, Kevin, you've got Bernanke, who on 60 Minutes a month or so ago said with 100% certainty that he would pull back the liquidity at exactly the right time. And I think this is a perfect case in point, Kevin, where things can be staged such that they look like heroes in the midst of offering a QE3 and QE4, but the step sequence to get there is critical. What they need to do, and we don't know that they will, but it sure makes sense that they would take away QE2 and not complete the full $600 billion between now and June. Maybe that's sometime in May. We're at 450, we're at 500, we're at 550. But like knights on a white horse, they ride in and say, do you see the economic recovery? Do you see the success of our policies? We have achieved what we wanted to, and it's not necessary to go the full 600. We are ending it short.
Well, Plosser, you know, of the Atlanta Fed, has already made comments about possibly being able to end QE2 early.
He said last Friday, monetary policy will have to reverse course in the not-too-distant future and begin to remove the massive amount of accommodation it supplied to the economy. Failure to do so in a timely manner would have serious consequences for inflation and economic stability in the future. Kevin, I think what they're setting themselves up for is, again, this hero status where we told you that our policies were working, we told you that we were in control, we told you that we knew when to take away the stimulus. And here's the thing, Kevin, as we get into the summer or fall, we look at the landscape that we're in today, and there are hundreds of different things that could cause the need for another quantitative easing.
Well, and didn't Plosser even mention a couple himself? I mean, he said said, that's assuming Japan can stabilize its nuclear reactors and that the Saudi family isn't in threat. You know, he's already throwing things out that we're like, there's a problem here that they're not solving.
But what has to be proven out is that we're in control and you need to trust us.
Right.
And we told you that we would take it away if necessary and if we had that luxury. And in fact, we did. So we took it away. Now, the fact that we have QE3 or QE4, this is a separate issue. This was foisted upon us by exogenous or external events, things that were out of our control. Now we have to respond to them as we would to any particular instance. We solved the past problems. Now we have new present and future problems because of these new circumstances.
So the Federal Reserve actually trying to talk about austerity is like a drug dealer offering a rehabilitation program. He's not going to offer it for long.
It could be his best way of cornering the market and figuring out who his competition are and squeezing them out. Certainly the Fed's good at that. Kevin, speaking of austerity, want to go back to the German elections because it was just this last weekend. We looked at the Baden-Württemberg election as a critical one.
Merkel's
for
in trouble.
Merkel's party. And yes, she lost again. The argument was that the Greens got more votes in Germany. That's a party in Germany, the Green Party. And that they did so on the basis of Merkel's response to the nuclear issue. But what that ignores is all of the other states throughout Germany where she has lost when the nuclear issue was not an issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, what you really have is the austerity measures being viewed as a bit ridiculous, where taxpayers are bearing the burden that should have gone to bondholders and banks. And this is the point, Kevin, where you're seeing a revolt in Europe against this very thing.
Do you think people actually understand what's going on, or do you think they're just feeling the pain?
I think it's a combination of feeling the pain and seeing that someone else isn't feeling the pain, and that's very frustrating.
Right.
When you know that you're paying a price, and it's all well and good if socially, you know, I pay a price, you pay a price, but somehow it just doesn't seem fair when I pay the price and you don't have to.
We're feeling that here in America as well. I mean, you think of how many blue-collar workers, even white-collar workers, are out of work right now, yet bankers are receiving record bonuses at this point.
And again, Kevin, this is more interesting from the standpoint of social commentary than it is critique, because I mean, what you have is a growing social instability wherein, again, blue collar workers are saying this just isn't fair. We've got this new movie receiving ample awards and accolades, The Inside Job. Mm. And this is, again, does art reflect culture or culture art? You've got this movie which is acting as a voice for the blue collar workers saying, hey, this just isn't right. Again, what's my position on that? Doesn't matter. What I'm particularly interested in is that there is a development. There's a movement at the grassroots level, Kevin, where the banks are going to have to pay. The financial executives are going to have to pay. Over in Europe, it's the bondholders will pay. They will take the haircut. Not just the man in the street. It's not just us subject to austerity measures, but everyone's got to be on the same level of pain.
A couple of hundred years ago, this led to the guillotine in France, Dave. Okay, David, going back then to the dilution of currency, okay, because that's what we were talking about. Gold, we have talked about before, being a CPI indicator. You were saying it's very hard to value things such as stocks, bonds, whatever, when you've got a change in the value of the currency. But isn't gold keeping up very well with meter of the CPI?
Kevin, it depends on your perspective on that. If you look over long periods of time, then it's a very good mirror for inflation.
Right.
If you're looking at a quarter-to-quarter report and saying, okay, the CPI is up, is gold up or down, then you could crucify gold as some sort of a corresponding relationship. But it is over that long period of time, say a 5-year period, a 2-year period, a 10-year period, a 20, 30, 40-year period.
A 1,000-year period.
Where you begin,
whatever.
Exactly, you see gold mirroring the increase in the money supply and the way that that's reflected in the repricing of real goods and services. What's interesting, Kevin, is that the CPI, at least the way we measure inflation here in the United States, and that correspondence to the gold price started to fall apart in 2008. And I don't know if that's because of an increased interest in gold or because there's been an excessive amount of manipulation in the CPI and in the various indicators there. Maybe they've chosen the wrong things to measure. Maybe they need to relook at how they measure inflation in the first place.
Which is what a former guest of ours and a current read of ours continually says, John Williams, who just publishes the real numbers, and we're not seeing the real inflation.
Kevin, as we'll explore today, it may be that the understatement of CPI is actually the desired reading. Before we lose your interest in the bottom line here, the CPI and sort of the financial jargon, just let's review that. The CPI, as we know, measures the rise in the cost of goods.
Right.
Inflation itself is growth in money and credit, which precedes the repricing of those goods and services. And so, I mean, it's a little bit, Kevin, like measuring the number of inches of rainfall. The rain is one thing. The measurement is an indication of the quantity of rain, which is something different, even if only by a minor nuance. At the consumer level, we have the CPI, which is supposed to measure price changes. Take out food, take out fuel, and throw in a generous percentage reflecting rent, because that's how they calculate it. Kevin, the real backstory here is the increase in liquidity, either through a change in interest rates or money supply growth. That's what's behind the scene, ultimately showing up in a CPI measurement, now understated, but still some indication of inflation.
Well, you know, I hear from so many people who've had standard economics courses or just read the paper that a couple of percent inflation is actually preferable. Is it? Is it something that puts money in people's pockets, or is it something that takes away?
Well, if I'm the thief, I would prefer that you be very comfortable with making that voluntary donation to me. But that's essentially what inflation is, Kevin. It's legalized theft. Inflation is, in fact, theft.
So basically, David, we've had a whole generation of people instructed that they should look for inflation and fear deflation.
Well, that's correct, Kevin. I mean, what is the number on a coin, on a banknote? It's the value that's implied that currency note or coin represents. If you take that banknote and you cut it in half, you're going to find very few people who are willing to accept the banknote at all,
right,
let alone believe they're being given full value for the note. In fact, a note is so impaired, it's probably no longer exchangeable.
Well, you know, David, you were talking about shaving coins. This is something that's been throughout the centuries when gold and silver coins were used, or even other types like copper. The way inflation would occur is either the dilution of the metal, just put other metals in until the original precious metal's no longer there, or they would shave the edges. And a lot of people don't really know that the ridges around the coin on a quarter is to keep that actually from happening.
Well, that's the exact point, Kevin, because government acknowledged that people would try to cheat the system by shaving coins, and so they created a design on coins that didn't have a smooth surface on the edge, but instead had this reading or fluting on the edge.
Right.
What happens when you shave the coin? It's very obvious, and you take it out of circulation immediately.
And the government can't do that to you. You can't do it to the government. Everybody continues with a constant weight and measure.
But in fact, that's what government has foisted on the public. They're shaving coins, and people pretend that that's not happening to them,
well,
with
then
that stated inflation rate of 2% per year.
Well, then, David, isn't it curious that investors assume constant value with their currency, even though the opposite fact is the case?
Well, yeah, you take the dollar as the primary example. From 1950 to present, a dollar's been cut to 11 cents in its purchasing power, leaving that venerable banknote, if trimmed with scissors, is nothing more than a bookmark, Kevin, a memory for the owner of some nostalgic state that currency had, a value of yesteryear. You know, so what is the piece of paper worth? You look at the full banknote, and even though inflation has eroded its value and cut away 89% of its value, you and I pretend to ignore. You and I pretend to ignore and still spend that money as if it is a representative value, as if it is a unit of measurement, like we were talking about earlier, Kevin, as if it is a unit of measurement and there is some solid, objective value to it.
Well, you know, David, that's an interesting point, because we think back, we go, oh, gosh, well, we've lost 89% of our value in the currency, but that was yesterday. That's not today. But today, we're being told 2% is the goal. Okay, that's the goal. Now, at 2%, someone ran these numbers for us. $100,000 at 2% inflation in 10 years is only worth $81,707.
So you've lost about $19,000 in purchasing power in the course of a decade.
That's only 2%.
Yeah, but that's the intention of government, is to only steal $19,000 of your $100,000 over the next decade. That's supposed to be acceptable to you, Kevin. That's supposed to be acceptable to me. And we exist with this as normal.
So people with kids or grandkids in 20 years that they're saving for, okay, 20 years at 2%, David, takes it down to about 66,000. $100,000. $100,000 is reduced to $66,000. Now, that's 2%. What if it's 4%? What if they're not telling us the truth?
You're having to pay for this monetary policy, and that's the price. That's the price. And that's if the inflation rate is 2%. As we've discussed a number of times before, you've got the magician or the entertainer who uses the art of misdirection to focus your attention on what he or she wants you to see, so that they can in turn sort of work their trickery without being noticed. You've got the target of 2, which does not reflect the flexibility the Bureau of Labor Statistics has in coming up with the number to show the Fed's
success. Sure, we know they doctor it.
Yeah, the looseness of the modeling and the CPI over the years has put the Fed in the position to essentially grade their own work. You know, I mean, they can call it a success, they can call it 2%, they can call it... How do we know that they've met their number? Well, through the years, they've actually changed the constituent parts in the CPI in order to achieve and again, give themselves the A grade.
Okay, so what you're saying is, not only do they flute the coin, but then they shave the coin and reflute the coin.
Yes,
and tell you everything's fine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's far more important, Kevin, if they are in fact understating inflation. Again, misdirection in this case is the discussion of the successful, quote-unquote, successful monetary policy operation, which has achieved 2% inflation. And again, their excuse is that this is geared to spur economic growth, while, in fact, the real number is closer to 4 to 5%. Again, John Williams says it's closer to 8% currently, but let's take a conservative look at that and say, no, just 4%, they're understating it by 2, and they're doing it on purpose.
So that 4%, we just talked about the run, that takes it down instead of to $66,000. That $100,000 is reduced to $44,000 in buying power. That's just with 4%.
If I get a little hot under the collar, Kevin, it's because that's what I'm talking about. Inflation is theft.
Yes.
It's theft. And you've been conditioned, I've been conditioned to believe that this is healthy.
Right.
You're donating not only your tax dollars to the Treasury, but now the Fed is absolutely sticking it to you, and you're supposed to smile about it.
As a student, I was taught that a little bit of inflation is really, really quite nice. It's like what we were talking about the other day. Hold still, little fish, while I gut you.
Exactly, Kevin. That was Malcolm Bryan, who worked for the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta earlier in this century. He was absolutely opposed to the idea of targeting inflation.
Not even fractional inflation.
No, not at all. He said, if a policy of active or permissive inflation is to be a fact, then we can rescue the shreds of our own self-respect only by announcing the policy. That is the least of the canons of decency that should prevail. We should have the decency to say to the money saver, hold still, little fish. All we intend to do is get you.
And this is somebody who worked for the Federal Reserve. So actually, they're not all bad guys.
Okay, in this case, I don't think he was particularly popular at the Fed. But so the question is, Kevin, if in fact this art of misdirection is in play, and they're saying, look over here, we've succeeded with our 2% inflation rate, and it's healthy, it's spurring economic growth, and the growth in the economy more than makes up for the 2% that we've just stolen from you, although they wouldn't use that term. What if in fact the art of misdirection is 2%? Covers over the fact that the real world inflation rate is 4 to 6. Is there a really big difference?
Well, there is a difference for the owner of assets, obviously.
And there's also a difference for creditors, owners of the liability.
Okay, but how about the debtor? Okay, that we've often heard a person who's in debt, they'll go, well, you know, and we've even talked about it, Dave. If the bank's going to take a risk and let you pay 4, 4.5% for your house, and we know that inflation may be higher than that, isn't the debtor winning?
In fact, that is the case. Allowance of any inflation favors debtors to creditors, but it also encourages speculation for some, while others, it encourages rampant consumption beyond your means. And certainly, again, it discourages saving altogether. But let's look at each one of those, Kevin, the debtor, the saver, the creditor, the consumer, and see what ways in which it actually benefits.
So to all four, the debtor, saver, creditor, consumer. And if it's understood, a person can actually possibly protect themselves or at least understand why they're being hurt, why they're being gutted.
And I might even suggest that there's a moral dimension to the debtor here, which you should be very careful of, because someone ultimately pays the price.
Right.
In taking advantage of this system, just understand that someone has to make up the difference somewhere. And maybe that's just in a big boy world, we all figure out someone else is on the hook for that. They place their bet, you place theirs, and you won.
So you're talking morals and ethics here. It's 2011, Dave.
I know it might be inappropriate to discuss those things when it comes to money and politics or anything else, but let's look at the debtor.
Okay.
Over time, a fixed rate debt is paid back with devalued currency if you've got inflation in the mix. Inflation to the debtor is a form, actually, Kevin, of debt forgiveness. Mm. To a debtor, this is probably something that sounds intriguing and even desirable, but there's two parties that, as we mentioned, do pay for that debt relief. So what benefits one party is a price that has to be paid directly by another. Think of this instead of debt forgiveness, Kevin, as substitutional payments.
You know, that brings me to a point of someone the other day was so angry. They had just seen a commercial for a guy who owed over $100,000 on his taxes. And it was one of those commercials where it says, we owed $100,000 on our taxes, and we called this number, and we've only had to pay $2,000. What made the person mad was he knew who was covering the rest of the bill, and it was him. It was the guy who actually just pays his taxes.
Right. Well, then you've got the saver, Kevin. The other category, the saver has a high hurdle to get over for those saving to maintain a positive rate of return. You've got inflation plus taxes, and that equals the number that a saver has to reach to just to break even,
right?
Let alone have something in excess to either live off of, supplement income, or grow the asset
base. That's called a positive rate of return, positive over inflation.
Exactly. Yeah. Positive over inflation and your taxes. Oftentimes, if interest rates are low and inflation is high, a saver loses money every year.
Right.
And Keynes was keen on this idea because he thought that savings were a bad thing. Punishing the saver was just fine to John Maynard Keynes because the more you could force savers to spend, the more economic activity you could stir and generate. So by all means, take away all the benefits from a saver. I mean, when you look at Keynesian policy, low rates, ample liquidity, which is inflationary, who pays the price? The saver. Who was in John Maynard Keynes's crosshairs?
Right.
That's right. The rentier class, the rentier, the old R-E-N-T-I-E-R class, these
well,
are
we
the landowners.
Call it landlord. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A landlord who had capital tied up in a particular asset, be that real estate or a farm or whatnot, and was receiving lease money from the farm or income from the person who was living in that property.
That allowed him to be an owner and someone who could profit from his assets versus having it spent into the economy and profiting the whole.
And Keynes's system was all based on the cumulative effect of all assets working in the economy at all times.
Right. Which means you shouldn't save.
But that's the point. The saver is looking for a net positive income from his assets. Instead of consuming, instead of buying, he has given up the consuming tendency and said, no, I'd like to do something else with this. There is a reward for doing this. Assuming that there's a reward, he'll continue to save.
Okay, but for every borrower, there has to be a lender. What about the creditor in this market? If you've got inflation, what happens to the creditors out there?
Well, Kevin, before we go there, one more thing on the savers, because this is important. It's an important dynamic that takes place in an environment just like this. If a saver does not have a net positive income, what they do is they're often forced to seek risky assets to remain in positive territory. The rate of return has to stay positive, but they can't keep it down at the bank, so now they've got to go buy something far more speculative just to have the same rate of return in order to afford their lifestyle or pay their bills or whatnot.
Which is just almost, that's just self-sacrifice at that point. You know, David, I've talked to people for years about their money, so have you. The age 50 to 60 is what I call the danger years, because guys hit 50 or 51, 52, and they start going, oh, I don't have enough to retire. I better get in there and start taking more risk. And what happens is that nest egg, whatever little nest egg or large nest egg they have, goes under extreme pressure in those years because they're taking extra risks. They're realizing they don't have the buying power to retire.
And that's true of a demographic. This is the case, Kevin, where monetary policies are forcing savers to become speculators.
Mm.
So it creates that same kind of circumstance you're talking to, but artificially, it doesn't matter what age you are, it takes you out from being a little old lady with $100,000 at the bank who's just trying to supplement her income. And it's not working.
Yeah.
So you either spend principal or go speculate. That's what modern monetary policy is doing to savers.
Okay, then let's go to the creditor, Dave.
Kevin, the creditor, I mean, when we talk about a creditor, we're talking about an organization like a bank or any lending institution. If they've loaned money, they've done it with a certain understanding of an economic backdrop, Kevin. And, you know, if they are accepting of the CPI numbers, then they're assuming that inflation today is no issue at all. And they probably will ignore the slow erosion of value. And specifically, what I mean by the slow erosion of value is they lent out money at a particular point in time. Each year they're receiving payment of principal and interest back, but they're getting it back at a discount from the original loan price if, in fact, those CPI numbers are too low. So if CPI is understated, the creditor is getting his head handed to him.
You know, David, you were talking about the creditor being a bank or some lending institution, but you and I are also lending institutions every time we buy a bond. Every time we put money into a bond, we're really lending money to somebody. So in reality, it also is me. That
right.
Banker can be me.
Well, exactly. So what about the creditor trying to factor in a real-world inflation number?
Right.
What you'll see is that interest rates have to be pushed up in order to compensate for that increased rate of inflation. This is something, Kevin, that is interesting because it means that investors and creditors are at odds and are potentially being abused by central bank monetary policy decisions as well.
Right. These interest rates are staying unnaturally low right now. There's no possible way that a bondholder, especially a safe bond such as a government type of bond, is keeping up with inflation.
No, it will take significantly higher interest rates in the future to reflect the several variables which are neglected today. Not only a change in credit quality, which is happening right now. We're watching balance sheets continue to erode,
right,
particularly in the public space, as the private sector has cleaned up their balance sheets by shifting all their bad loans onto the public ledger. Now the public has to figure out how to pay those bills, and we're looking at downgrades. Already seen that in the municipal space, and we'll see that in the treasury markets, I think, Kevin, in 2011 and 12. But debtors are, in effect, being marked to market. And this is what I mean by that. If you have the U.S. government, which has an awful balance sheet, but they're being treated like an A-quality credit,
right,
and they're almost insolvent, eventually, you're going to have to quit pretending. Eventually, you're going to have to quit, quote-unquote, marking to make believe and assuming that the government is always going to be solvent. And there will be a revolution in value as the credit quality is questioned and the bonds are revalued overnight. Kevin, you also have the other side of that, which is in an era of eroding or changing monetary value, specifically inflation, you're going to have to see those bonds reflect an imputed inflation rate.
Okay, so David, John Maynard Keynes in his perfect world gets his perfect way, and we're all just consuming. We take in money, we spend it. What about the consumer? This consumption is 70% of our GDP. So obviously, that applies to a couple of people who are listening to this show right now.
Absolutely. Well, and this is the thing. You create a world where there's no real advantage to saving.
Right.
With no real return on your savings or flat returns, if we're going to be generous, you can look at a former saver who's turned to a consumer. Guess what? They're going to spend simply because they don't want to lose value.
Right.
There's really no reason. I mean, if you're out on a Friday night with a couple of friends and you say, gosh, I really should watch my budget because I've been trying to save for X, Y, or Z, and you look at how discouraging real-world inflation is, you say, you know what the heck, it just doesn't matter. I'm never going to get ahead anyways. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow, the Fed has taken me to the cleaners.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. You know, David, this reminds me of a missionary who visited us years ago from Belarus, and they had an inflation rate that just destroyed their currency. About every 6 weeks, their currency, whatever they were paid before, was no longer worth anything. And he came in, he actually gave me some of his currency. It wasn't worth anything when he handed it to me. It's hanging on my wall. But he was puzzled as to why Americans save. It was outside of the realm of his world. They didn't save anything. When they got paid, they spent. What they didn't spend, they gave to the church or gave to orphanages, what have you. But there was no way they were going to actually try to save money because they had never experienced a currency that wasn't devaluing faster than any asset or any type of investment that they could buy.
When, Kevin, in an environment where there is no inflation, an investor or a saver will have a reasonable choice as to how to allocate their assets.
Right.
With mild inflation, you have savers which are discouraged from doing that very thing. With radical inflation, you actually have an encouragement of consumption on a day-by-day or even hour-by-hour.
Like this person from Belarus.
So exactly, yeah. Because the process of currency devaluation is shrunk into a perceivable time frame. This is how the Fed can get away with creating 2% to 4% inflation, and the average consumer doesn't care.
Because they don't really feel it day to day, right?
Well, this is curious, but if you look at a 2% inflation rate, and that's the current Fed target, Kevin, over a 365-day period, if you stretch that 2% out over a one-year period, you're talking about 0.00005479% of inflation per day.
Hardly noticeable.
You don't notice it at all.
Yeah.
You know, but here's the thing. Even with an annual inflation rate of 10% per year, which you think, oh, well, now we're talking about real money.
Sure, now I know.
But you know what? On a daily basis, you're still not going to react to it. You're still not going to freak out. Why? Because you're talking about 0.00027% per day. The first issue is there's no upside on savings. The second issue is you panic into spending whatever you have because you realize you've got to get something for it at some point. Somewhere in between is the Keynesian dream. He wasn't after an inflationary nightmare, but he certainly didn't want to see people sitting on savings. He wanted to see full employment. He wanted to see a full usage of capital.
He loved the velocity of money. Let's face it. I mean, if he loved anything, he loved the velocity of money. Okay, David, you were talking about how little we can actually feel on a daily basis, but even in today's market, people will still call a trillion a sizable amount of money. Okay, and with all of our debts nationally added up to about $52 trillion, we're talking a 2% inflation rate sucks over $1 trillion a year just in the buying power out of the system.
Right. This is why when you wonder if inflation is the answer, if the Fed is open to having a stated 2% and running perhaps a real world of 4 or 5, this is why. Because, you know, the number that you quoted doesn't include unfunded liabilities. Throw in the unfunded liabilities and it takes us not from 52, but up to $70 trillion, over $70 trillion, you know, over the next 25, 30 years that we've got to pay.
$1.5 trillion almost being sucked out of the system using the Fed's number where they say, oh yeah, 2%, that's our goal.
As boring as this may sound, this is the value of compound interest. Because just as a savings rate and a positive rate of return grows your money, having a debt with a negative carry on it, guess what that does? It compounds negatively.
That's a negative compound interest.
It's a negative compound interest.
Yeah.
The best hope that the Fed has, and this is why inflation is already baked into the cake, the best hope that the Fed has is to allow that 2% to be there, misdirect our attention to the 2%, allow the 4% to carry. Kevin, over the next 18 years, at a 4% rate of inflation, we're going to cut that $70 trillion liability into a $35 trillion liability, something that is more attainable and more affordable. Now, if, on the other hand, it's an 8% rate of inflation, now we're talking about cutting our debt in half, not over an 18-year period, but we're shrinking the time frame. And all of a sudden, that doesn't matter.
And David, as you pointed out before, this brings us to the moral issue. This is the moral ethical issue, because even though the nation may be decreasing how much in real dollars they're having to pay debt back, the real loser, what we've talked about before, the people who are not involved in that elite system.
Right. Kevin, well, I guess one of the arguments is that if you are an owner of assets, then certainly you benefit from a repricing of inflation.
A lot of our listeners are sitting here listening to this going, well, I've taken care of that. I own assets that I can trade in for more dollars later.
Right. Well, and with a consistent and mild inflation, you see an increase in asset values and over a long period of time, a significant step up in return on your original investment.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, for instance, that you built a plant in 1950,
okay,
for $1 million, a significant investment at the time, and today are looking at walking away. You're now at an age where you want to retire, you want to pass this on to someone else, and you're liquidating the asset for $9 million.
You think you've made money.
You think you have, and yet again, you look at the purchasing power of money from 1950 till now, and your $1 million, now $9 million, is still only the million that you had.
So what if you got 6 or 5 million?
Not only are you a loser because the dollar has lost value during that period of time, but guess what else? The Treasury is going to ask you to pay a capital gains tax on the liquidated value. The reality is, with a constant unit of measurement, that wouldn't be the case.
Right.
But you're going to pay a tax on a fictional profit, and that fictional profit is based on an inflated value as a result of a devalued currency.
And you're paying an inflated tax, let's face it. I mean, the Treasury still gets away with murder on this one because the tax that you're paying is inflated on buying power.
Kevin, I guess this brings us back to the critical issue. As investors, we assume that we understand our money.
Right.
We look at a bank statement, we look at an investment statement, and we assume that it means something to us. And yet, it means something different every day, depending on the time slice we choose. What is the dollar worth today versus yesterday, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or even tomorrow? Kevin, I think this is where we are assuming that we are using a value that is a constant unit of measurement, when in fact we are not. It's utter fiction. It's utter fiction. And we've been duped into playing this game. We've been duped into playing this game, and we've been robbed blind. We've been robbed blind. This is the value of monopoly central banking. I mean, I wish I had one. I'd have to check my spirit and soul at the door, because ethically, I don't think it flies.
Right.
But in terms of a business model where you market yourself as being the stabilizer of the system, while at the same time robbing the system blind, I mean, you realize that the idiots out there are the ones who are in Sing Sing prison because they tried to walk in the bank in the front door and hold up the bank.
Instead of being the banker for themselves.
Yeah. And you could do the same thing with a gun to the head of every depositor. And who cares? If you're a central banker, you get to rob the public year in and year out.
Well, David, I think about how we have to make decisions every day based on certain standards, certain constants. Okay. Even the way we get up in the morning and walk around the room, we're basing that on our knowledge of gravity, which doesn't change much in our lifetimes. Okay. I'm thinking about, in Sèvres, France, in a climate-controlled locked vault, there's an international prototype of a kilogram. Okay. Now, why is it important to have something that is exactly 1 kilogram? I think it's made out of platinum. Okay. And
because they don't want it to atomically deteriorate at all.
That's
right.
We
need to know what our kilogram is, the constant value through time. Through this, we derive grams, we derive micrograms, we derive all of these other variations.
All of our scientific measurements. And this thing's been around 120 years, and they've made more, and they test them against each other. They're continually testing because they need to have a standard. I mean, a kilogram is the same weight roughly as a, well, not roughly, it's supposed to be exactly what a liter of water would weigh at a certain temperature. Now, with that care being taken, you know, you look at the monetary system. What if we actually took care that way? What would something be worth, our work, our 8 hours a day for a lifetime? What would that be worth if we would have had a standard unit of measure in our money?
Well, and this is one of the things. I remember the Harvard study by two gals. This goes back over 10 years, and they were talking about dual-income families.
Right.
The fact that today, for the same lifestyle that we had 30, 40 years ago, it takes two people working. And we've grown socially accustomed to the fact that we want opportunity. We want it now. We want two cars, a two-car garage, a house that we like, white picket fence. We want the American dream, and we want it now. But guess what? That used to be achievable, even if you had to wait a few years and
with a single income.
With a single income.
Yeah.
But again, there's been a lot of social arguments for why we need to break down gender barriers and everyone gets to work. That's not our point. We're not having that discussion today. What we're talking about is when you destroy a currency and it happens over a slow period of time, there will be justifications for why two people need to work. But the baseline is this. You have to.
Right.
You have to have two people working to do what one person used to be able to do. That, too, is a present to you, a gift from the Federal Reserve.
David, to bring a little gallows humor into this, because I'm sure no one was laughing when it actually happened, but about a dozen years ago, we had our internet connection set up. I was here at the office. Now, I normally don't do this while we're working at the office, but I was at JPL's, Jet Propulsion Laboratory's website, and I was ready to listen to the first audio from Mars. They had never actually taken a microphone.
So this is the Mars probe that they sent?
Yeah.
And now they're sending the recording. The recording is supposed to come back.
This was in the late 90s. Okay. And I had tracked this mission. I'm sort of a space geek anyway. And so I had watched when it was launched. I couldn't wait for it to get there. I had it on my calendar to turn everything on because I wanted to hear the wind and I wanted to hear the sand. I wanted to hear everything on Mars. And there was a strange silence, Dave, and it just stayed silent. Minutes passed, and it stayed silent. And the scientists scratched their head, and they said, what happened here? Well, it took months, but they finally figured out. Now, they still don't know whether it slammed into the planet, or if it burned up in the atmosphere, or if it just flew past the planet. But the point is, when they got together, they said, hey, guys, did you use meters, or did you use feet? And half of them had used meters, and half of them had used feet. Well, when there's not an agreement on a unit of measurement, you have no sounds coming from Mars. I'm sorry.
I know you're studying celestial navigation right now, which is kind of fun. You're using the old sextant. If you were out at sea and had no GPS, how would you make your way from island A to island B or across the Atlantic? How would you do that just navigating from the stars?
Right.
You've got all of these variable factors,
sure,
things that are not
moving,
in your control.
The stars are moving, the moon's moving, there's declinations changing. But what you do have is you've got a sextant that is very, very precise in measuring angles. That's all you need. Precise measurement of angles and knowing the constants of these moving, what seem like variables are actually constants. But the beauty is, you can actually measure, David. I mean, GPS is the same thing. It's an older form of GPS. You can measure down to a very, very small area of error. So you know where you're going and you don't run into the rocks.
Well, I think this is the frustrating thing for me, Kevin, because when I think about investing today, and we've had this conversation many times, the need to analyze value in relative terms,
right,
is because we do not have a measurement which helps us appreciate that relationship of value between one item and another on its own. If things were as they were during the gold standard era, 1860 to 1914, priced in gold terms, then you're just looking at one item versus another and determining its value in a constant. We really don't have that anymore.
Right.
Which means the best that we can do is suck dollars out of the equation, since it's the variable which we don't know up, down, short-term, long-term, what direction it goes.
And measure real things versus real things? Is that where you're going?
Right. Yeah. Well, because a real thing used to actually be our money system.
Yeah.
That's not the case with a fiat money system anymore. But it puts an investor at an extreme disadvantage. How do you measure one asset versus another? How do you allocate into assets one class versus another when you have no constants?
Right.
When the gauge is a variable.
Is this why you've been a proponent of the Dow gold ratio, or the silver gold ratio, or the real estate gold ratio?
All of these things are unfortunately necessary,
right,
because our money isn't telling us the story of value.
So without a calculator, you're really not going to know what things are valued at. Without a calculator and maybe what today's price for gold is, you really don't know what anything else is worth.
Having to price things in relative terms signifies how far we've come in bankrupting this idea of sound money. We left it in the 60s and 70s completely on a global basis, and that leaves investors at an extreme disadvantage. To understand and appreciate where we go from here, Kevin, I think it is worth looking back to that period where we had a unit of measurement that signified something of constants.
Well, David, it doesn't just apply to Mars probes, and it doesn't just apply to celestial navigation. It obviously applies to our livelihood. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can always give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.